Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. So glad to have you listening to the podcast today. And kind of a different show for you today. Not going to talk with any of the members of the General Assembly, get hot and heavy into policy, but we're going to talk about an organization, the North Carolina Rural Center, and officially the North Carolina Rural Economic Development Center, and its president, Patrick Woody. And there are a lot of occasions when talking about the economy in North Carolina where inevitably the challenges facing the rural part of our state are mentioned, and things like infrastructure and really the economic growth that we've seen in other parts of the state have not seemed to trickled into the rural areas as much. And so we're going to talk with Patrick Woody about that, about the Bright Futures Act, a bill filed by Representative Zoka, which, among other things, would move to extend broadband capabilities throughout rural North Carolina. And we'll also talk to him about a banking symposium they had last week and some of the challenges rural areas are facing when it comes to banking. So lots of good content for you with Patrick Woody of the North Carolina Rural Center. It's a pleasure to welcome to What Matters in North Carolina, Patrick Woody. He is president of the North Carolina Rural Economic Development Center, or Rural Center for short. And Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I've been looking forward to talking with you, and what caught my eye initially was reading about a rural banking symposium that took place a couple of days ago, and I thought, well, it'd be interesting to talk with you guys, and also a bill that's been filed in the General Assembly regarding extending broadband to rural areas. Representative Zoka of Cumberland County has filed that bill, so I thought, well, we might have a lot to talk about, so let me just see if we can do that, and I appreciate you joining us on the show. First of all, how was the symposium, and what was the main thing that you took away from that?
Well, we were really pleased to host a symposium on the future of rural banking. It was held here at the Rural Center in our conference center on Thursday of last week. There was a great cross-section. First of all, I think it was the fact that the right people were in the room. We really did have a broad cross-section of people who either work in the industry or are community groups closely tied to the industry. We had about 100 attendees representing banks, community certified development financial institutions, also known as CDFIs, and several of the credit unions across North Carolina were also in attendance, along with a lot of the nonprofit groups that work to boost community-based lending in their communities. And the conversation really was all about the future of rural banking. We see a number of trends in the banking industry, just like we see in other industry sectors at large, that affects what has always been sort of the traditional branch bank. And what the data tells us is that sort of the demographics of rural tends to push rural in a direction that it is more dependent on branch banks than perhaps other more urban locations might be. And at the same time, it's kind of hard to aggregate all the data across the nation, but it is clear that as we've seen a lot of consolidation happening within the banking industry and a number and fewer branches all across the country, rural banking has been impacted more so than urban or metropolitan banking since the beginning of the Great Recession back in 2007-08.
Well, let me just jump in. And as I think about rural communities and towns and cities in North Carolina, it almost seems natural that folks go to the bank and they know the tellers and they know the folks that they're getting their loans from. And so is it more a function of community as opposed to anything that might be deemed negative. In other words, you know, it's a smaller town. I mean, it's folks know everybody, and so they've been going to the bank all their lives, and, you know, it's like going to the drugstore, and you know the pharmacist. And,
that's right.
You know, so where's the tension in that regard?
Well, it is the nature of small communities, and certainly the way we think about it is, you know, you think of any community, you think of sort of those essential ingredients that make up a community. And if you think just of the business side of what you would expect to find in even a small community, there are certain what we would call anchor businesses that are a part of that business environment. And among those would certainly be a branch bank location, mm-hmm. Or it could even be a hometown community bank. And we certainly know how those have gone away in recent years. But you have the local hardware store, you have the local retail pharmacy, you have, you know, a local auto parts mechanics business, and it is the nature of it that everybody knows everybody. And, you know, businesses need to make daily deposits for the most part. As the businesses in the community close up, those business owners are used to dropping off their deposits at a branch depository. If there's not a branch in town, that creates a whole set of problems for the business owners. And certainly it's true that older individuals still strongly prefer the in-person banking experience. Some of our rural areas are not as well served with mobile, or can't access as easily mobile application or applications in online banking, all of which tends to make the branch banks very important to a rural community.
Our guest, Patrick Woody of the North Carolina Rural Center, we're talking a little bit about the bank symposium held a couple of days ago, talking about banking in rural areas of North Carolina. And in terms of the future of banking, which is what the title of the symposium was, the future of banking in rural North Carolina, and I don't want to, you know, bog down the entire interview on this, but what did you take away from as far as the future of banking in rural North Carolina? Is it a good future or one that gives pause for concern?
Well, I think it is a future that gives pause for concern in the smallest rural communities. And it's one that we should have our eyes wide open about. At the same time, I do think there are steps that we could take that we discussed last Thursday that will make sure that we're paying attention to the health of rural banking in general. One is just there are a few simple things we could do that would just make the flow, make it easier to aggregate the data about rural branch locations and the closures of all banks in a way that makes it more transparent and makes that data more accessible. Secondly, one of the things that was talked about was when a bank is really in a downsizing mode or is consolidating with another bank and it's going to lead to branch bank closures, is to make sure that there are very deliberative processes as a bank makes a decision to close a branch, that they are having an open conversation with the community about that decision ahead of time. Mm-hmm. There was a branch closure in Rich Square recently, that resulted in a closing of the only branch bank location in town. And one of the things that the bank agreed to do with the community is they actually donated the branch facility to the community.
Wow.
So that there was not making it easier for the town to deal with this vacant location, and either, you know, and hopefully be able to recruit or replace that bank and put something back in that building. So that's a very proactive, good step. That's a win for the community and a win for the bank that is, that is closing some branches. Another really intriguing notion, or it's intriguing to me, was there's at least one bank organization in the state that is experimenting with really training their branch employees to also be customer service representatives in an online or on the phone format. So in other words, to the extent they're not busy with branch bank customers, you know, sitting in front of them or standing in front of them at a teller location, they are available to answer calls as part of that bank's customer service center. So that there's really cross training and a good productive use for the bank of all their employees, regardless of how busy a branch location might be. And to me, that's a very intriguing idea that might tend to shore up and even increase the number of jobs in some rural banking locations.
Patrick, in terms of some other items that I wanted to speak with you about as far as rural North Carolina goes, we have heard, at least I have heard repeatedly in this forum in talking to various folks like yourself and people from the General Assembly and others, policy folks, that rural North Carolina is facing a lot of challenges. And we could list off, you know, infrastructure is possibly one of the biggest, but yes. Participating in the economic growth that the state would be another, that there just hasn't seemed to have flown into the rural areas the same type of economic growth that has flowed into the other more urban areas. So if you could nail down a couple, and I may have already just named them, but what do you see as the biggest challenges facing North Carolina's rural communities right now? And will you be advocating the General Assembly to address those challenges during this legislative session?
So the answer to the last question is yes, we will be advocating within the context of a policy framework that we set forth last year that we call Rural Counts, 10 Strategies for Rural North Carolina's Future. And I think the way we put that document together and the 10 strategies that are in fact part of that document kind of illustrate the first part of your question. If you look at most of those 10 strategies, it includes a lot of infrastructure components. It includes workforce development in our education system. It includes, you know, an emphasis on manufacturing, on value-added agriculture production. But in short, I think all of those strategies may also show up on an urban area's top 10 list of most important strategies that an urban area ought to be facing. The point is, and that I'd really like to make, is that the rural dimension of those issues is really completely different and unlike the urban dimension of those issues. And so it leads you to a conclusion that when we're talking about building a stronger state economy, that state economy is made up of both urban and rural components. And we really need to have economic development policy that is not one size fits all, that really meets a community where it is in terms of its economic development needs. It is certainly true that we've seen a robust economic recovery in this state. It is also true that economic recovery has not reached all places equally. And each, you know, depending upon where you're located in North Carolina, you have a unique set of assets. You have perhaps unique challenges, but also unique opportunities. And so our economic development policy as a state ought to really empower a community wherever it is to be able to, you know, use their assets to build upon, to address their opportunities, and to also address their challenges.
So in terms of the infrastructure situation, for example, let me see if I understand specifically, at least one of the primary factors in those challenges is that when you have smaller communities and smaller counties, the property tax base is just not as broad as it might be in a larger area, and therefore it's just a matter of not having enough revenue coming in to be able to renovate and remodel schools, for example, or build new roads, or enhance or replace or repair water and sewer and that sort of thing. Have I made it too simple?
I think in some ways that may be an oversimplification. I would say there definitely are very distressed towns and perhaps even some counties where tax-based generation is a major issue in terms of meeting the needs of that community. In a lot of places, I would say, that there's a pretty robust tax base in place. And again, that comes back to the to it depends on where you are. If we look at what we define as rural counties in North Carolina, we use a population density definition. And there are 80 North Carolina counties with population densities of less than 250 people per square mile. Hmm. We define those 80 counties as being rural counties. But within those 80 rural counties, 26 of them are within metropolitan service areas. There's no question but what in those 26 counties, the local economy is very much tied to a bigger metropolitan economy. If you look at commuter patterns, and it's actually quite fascinating to look at a commuter map of North Carolina, which illustrates the hub-and-spoke nature of our state's economy. And some of those hubs are actually larger rural communities. They're not all urban areas, but it shows all those interconnections of people going to work and where commerce is flowing and what that flow of commerce is. So those 26 counties, I would say, have, in general, stronger tax bases. They're able to meet their local community needs, but you can go into more remote and less dense places in our state, such as the Northeast, the Sandhill region along the South Carolina border, some places out west, and you can find communities that are struggling more so.
Hmm. Now, one of the things that you and your organization have been actively involved in is the recovery effort for Hurricane Matthew. Can you tell us, number one, how that's going and what kind of involvement you guys were able to what kind of help you were able to bring?
Sure. So we have had a history of being involved in long-term recovery from economic disasters going back to Fran and Floyd in the late 1990s. So it was kind of natural as we were looking at this major storm approaching that we were ramping up to be in a place to respond as best this organization could. We do a lot in the area of entrepreneurship, small business lending, and small business development. So we felt like that was the program area that we had the most to offer to our communities that really would be trying to recover after the storm. So we quickly began putting in place a response for small businesses that were affected by the hurricane. There was a emergency bridge loan program for businesses that was put in place after Hurricane Floyd that was an important part of the recovery. We were able to reach out to some of our bank partners, to the Golden Leaf Foundation, to help us fund a very similar response, an emergency bridge loan program. One of the issues after a disaster is there are federal resources. FEMA comes in, SBA comes in. They open up disaster recovery centers that are points of where people that have been directly affected can go to access assistance. In the beginning, it's simply along the lines of just getting through the disaster, and then attention turns to long-term economic recovery. And so now we've turned our attention really to long-term economic recovery, and it's a long road, and it's very hard work. And I would say that a number of communities in eastern North Carolina are still very much dealing with the realities of Hurricane Matthew after the fact. It takes a long time, several months, for insurance proceeds to find their way to a small business owner's pocket, or for long-term SBA financing to find its way to a small business owner. Our bridge loan program really is there to get funding, and it's not going to fully replace all their losses, but it's going to be funding that will help them get the business back open, deal with cleanup, get back on their feet as they go through the processes of either getting their insurance proceeds, if that's a possibility, or getting long-term SBA financing in place. So that bridge loan program was very much the initial part of our programmatic response to the hurricane. The second phase is also we do our best to connect rural community to resources that are available to them and help them understand those resources and navigate those systems. Long-term disaster recovery is very complicated, and there's a lot of moving pieces and parts, and it tends to be heavily bureaucratic. So we're hosting on February 28th, again, in our conference and training center, a resource fair day where communities, the organizations doing the, and often they're nonprofits, in some case they're municipalities or county governments, but we will really provide a day of training to help them understand all the moving pieces and parts of recovery that are important to the work they're trying to do on the ground in their own communities.
Well, certainly I have had on the show several times Mayor B.J. Murphy of Kinston,
yes,
who I'm sure you know. And
by
the way, this is my own personal fondness for Mayor Murphy, but if North Carolina had a mayor, I would vote for Mayor B.J. He loves that town so much. He loves his people. And I enjoy talking to him so much.
I follow him on Twitter and find, you know, he's always engaged in something going on in that community of Kinston. And, you know, it's a good example. Kinston is a great example of a community that has become more disaster resilient over time.
Uh-huh.
That's because of the leadership of people like Mayor Murphy. For example, there were a number of businesses that in the past have been completely shut down for weeks or even months that have learned from those past experiences that there are steps they take when they know a storm is coming that mitigates their losses and shortens the length of time that they're going to be down. The barbecue restaurant down there in Kinston actually moved every single thing out of that restaurant, put it on tractor trailers, moved it to higher ground. And so they really minimized the loss and damage, and they were back open in less than a week.
Wow.
And so it is definitely a learning process, and until you've been through this, there's a lot you may not understand about it. But as the cashier at that barbecue place told me a couple of weeks after they had reopened, she said, "This isn't our first rodeo."
Well, and, you know, if you know anything about Kinston barbecue, it's a pretty essential part of life down there.
That's right. You can't go too long without the barbecue place being open.
Exactly. As we come to the end of our time together, and I really feel like we just got started, perhaps we can do this again soon. But I wanted to talk to you about Representative Soka and
yes,
his Bright Futures Act. And this would do a lot of things, one of which would be to focus on bringing broadband capabilities and higher speeds to rural areas in North Carolina. I'm sure that you feel that's a good thing.
Oh, we absolutely do. As part of our advocacy work that we're doing in the General Assembly and really building, you know, a grassroots common voice for rural economic development across the state, broadband infrastructure is top on the list. As I've moved around and talked to legislators of both parties and in both houses, it is a hot topic also on Jones Street in the General Assembly. When this bill was dropped a couple of weeks ago by both some members of the Senate and members of the House leadership, it really got a lot of attention, and it certainly has our attention. I would say one thing that's important is sometimes we tend to overgeneralize that no rural part of our state has good broadband infrastructure, and that actually isn't the case. I think we can take some comfort and some pride in the fact that North Carolina has built a fairly robust and broad broadband infrastructure that reaches a lot of our state. That being said, if you are in one of those areas where it is not, either the speeds aren't adequate or the service is not very available at all, that's a major problem in the 21st century. And you know, your ability to do business is seriously dampened. It does take, again, as I said earlier, you've got to look at different regions of the state and where you're located. That's very true of broadband. If you're in an area that's not served, you need to know who the mix of players are in that area. And in all likelihood, it's going to take a combination of public and private partnership working together to solve those gaps in our broadband service. And that's really what I think Representative Zoka and Martin and Representative Sane, and on the Senate side, Senator Britt and Senator Davis, Senator Rabin, and others are really trying to get at is a recognition of what it's going to take to get broadband to those areas that are underserved.
Well, how would you respond to some conservatives who might say, well, it's really not government's job to be getting into this sort of thing, maybe using taxpayer dollars to, provide this kind of service, or that it might lead to, grants or something being given that might not, be the most efficient use of taxpayer money. How would you respond to that? Because I have read some of that criticism, and just wanted to see what you thought about that.
Well, I think we know, and, rural electricity is a great example of, there are economies of scale, and a lot of rural communities, that is one of the biggest thing that rural communities deal with is those economies of scale. And so the market in and of itself may not be incentive enough for some of the private incumbent providers to be able to, given their business model, to really invest in building a more robust broadband infrastructure in a given place. When that is the case, I fully respect their business model, but I think it is such essential infrastructure to every citizen, every school child, every business owner, that we need to be able to open up an area to other interested groups, and those may very well be for-profit enterprises.
Right.
And I think first and foremost, I would rather see a for-profit service that is interested in serving a rural area be able to do so. And there are things we can do to make to open up areas to competition for that. And I think that would result in some of our underserved areas probably being better served. But there may also be some cases where it would be appropriate to use either federal or state funding as a supplement to getting that really unserved areas served in some way. There's no question but what, as time goes on, technology is changing. The cost of serving some communities may come down over time. It probably will. And we certainly need to have our eye on cutting-edge technologies that may change the nature of the beast. But I've received emails from the mother in an eastern North Carolina small town who is sitting at 9:30 in the McDonald's doing homework with her kids because that's the only place they can go to get Wi-Fi service, allowing the child to get what they need via their handheld Wi-Fi device.
Wow.
And that's compelling to me. in terms of we've got to find answers for these really unserved and underserved rural communities. If the private sector can do it, we ought to explore every avenue for that, and that ought to be our first priority. But where appropriate, I think that particularly with public-private partnerships, where public funding can be used in a supplemental way, not in a way that totally builds it, but in a way that supplements the building of basic internet service.
Well, Patrick Woody, we're going to leave it right there. I would love to have you back as a guest. You are very knowledgeable and articulate, and I really sincerely appreciate you joining us today on What Matters in North Carolina. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mark. We sincerely appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. Well, it feels like the time just flew by there, and I definitely want to have Patrick Woody back on the show soon. So much to talk about when it comes to rural North Carolina and the challenges that they're facing. Appreciate the help that they have given the folks in eastern North Carolina in the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew, and they do a lot, and Mr. Woody obviously knows his stuff. I guess that's why he's the president, but interesting, talking about banking, I mean, you would think, as I mentioned, you know, small towns have a different approach to things like banking and pharmacies and things like that, and yet times are changing, and our rural area is going to be able to keep up when it comes to things like banking and keeping branches open, keeping the familiarity and that hometown feeling with residents who, you know, may have banked at the same place for decades. And yet, you know, things are changing. And how are rural small towns going to be able to handle that? So good stuff from Patrick Woody of the Rural Center. And this is not the last time we're going to talk about the Bright Futures Act. I can promise you that. That's going to be a piece of legislation heavily debated, and Lieutenant Governor Forrest is on board with that piece of legislation that's been proposed by Representative Zoka. And somewhere I read in the, I think it was in the Fayetteville Observer or one of the other newspapers in the middle part of the state, saying this is a great idea, and that just like water and electricity, we have become dependent upon the internet, and that government should treat internet access just like, you know, the utilities, water and electricity. And, I don't know. Yes, I think we would all freak out if we couldn't get online. But to equate it with a basic necessity of life and death, which would be water, I don't know, it might be a bit of a stretch, but we'll see how that bill goes, and we'll keep you up to date as it progresses through the House and Senate and see if it passes. Well, thank you so much for listening to What Matters in North Carolina today. We've had a big week so far and really enjoying. We had Greg Pulcher talking about craft beer on Monday. If you missed that, that's a booming industry, and you want to go back and listen to that. Of course, yesterday, Representative Steinberg and Mayor Peel from the northeastern part of the state talking about the wind farm and the impact that that's having in that area, Representative Steinberg's district, and then, of course, today, Patrick Woody. So you can find all of our great interviews and content at freedomactionnetwork.com and, of course, in the iTunes and Google Play stores as well. Thank you for listening. Once again, my name is Mark Shiver, and this is What Matters in North Carolina.